Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your volcanic and searing horn explosion of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonico. That was a little bit of a, not Miss Independent, but misunderstanding. That is coming from Kamasi Washington. Kamasi Washington is a saxophone player from Los Angeles. Ben Ratliff has been tracking him ruthlessly for nigh 12 months at this point.
That's true.
This Kamasi Washington story that is coming out in Arts and Leisure, I have been hearing whispers of it, of its impending magic for quite some time, and we are now blessed with it. And in those 12 months, a lot of interesting things have been happening for Kamasi Washington. Ben, why don't you set us up for who Kamasi is and what's the world that he's coming from? Because he may seem like an outlier, but that is false, it seems, if you look within the depths of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm.
Well, Kamasi Washington is 34, and he's a tenor saxophone player, and he's from South Los Angeles, as are a bunch of the people in his little circle. The Los Angeles jazz scene, it's not thriving. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
And currently, you mean?
Currently. I mean, it has been in the past. Mm-hmm. But the whole story of jazz in Los Angeles is kind of tricky because that's not the center of jazz performance. It's the center of, you know, film soundtracks and TV studios, and that's where a lot of musicians get their work.
A lot of session work.
And, right. Yep. There's also a strange culture of jazz out there, and always has been since the 40s and 50s. Those people stay there. They tend to stay there. And you go out to LA and you talk to jazz musicians, and they give you names of people who they believe are the greatest musicians ever to play jazz. And sometimes you've never heard of these names. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of amazing, you know? So the question is always why? Why don't they come to New York, or why don't they become band leaders and become part of the circuit
touring
that everybody knows?
Is there a lineage amongst those names, or is it just little eruptions at different points in time?
Oh, there's definitely lineage.
There's a clear lineage.
Yeah, and actually, so the story of Kamasi Washington is the story, in a way, of Los Angeles jazz since the 60s and 70s, because his father, Ricky Washington, is a jazz musician who played here and there and whatever, and when he was young, played in the Earth, Wind & Fire horn section.
Okay.
And then became a music teacher in public schools for 30-something years. These guys, who are all about the same age in Kamasi's circle, you know, they have parents or uncles or cousins or whatever, they're all sort of connected to people who have been active in jazz or funk or R&B. And also that stuff is much more connected. All those different kinds of music are more connected out there. You work where you work.
Sure.
You know what I mean? You work how you can. The decision to play jazz alone and nothing else, that doesn't come so easily out there. And maybe that's by choice.
One of the things that you mentioned in your piece, and I've read a little bit about elsewhere, is a lot of the folks in Kamasi's scene, Kamasi and a lot of his collaborators, played in high school bands, church bands. The sort of seeds of what we're seeing today for this mini scene really dates back 15 years.
There's 10 people in this collective called the West Coast Get Down. Mm-hmm.
Very West Coast name, just for the record.
Right.
Very like 90s West Coast.
Yeah.
Name. Yeah, really in it.
That collective changes shape and changes number according to who is the leader. Kamasi uses all 10 of them in his band, but other people in the band, when they are the leader of their own band, use fewer people. But it's always the same 10 guys. They went to different high schools because they were generally bust out of their own areas if they were gifted. And so they went to different high schools, but there was this one teacher, you know, who goes back to the 60s and 70s as an educator, who they all knew and who found out about them. He would pick them up after school and take them to a high school near Watts called Locke. And they all participated in this thing called the multi-school band. So here you have these people who might actually live close to each other, but they don't know each other because they all go to different schools being bused here and there. And then they come together at this place, Locke High School, for this after-school program. So that's how these people knew each other. In some cases, they actually did know each other as kids. Whether they knew each other as little kids or from high school, you know, now they're in their mid-30s. And they've just been playing together for so long that what you see when you go to one of – I've only seen Kamasi's gigs. I haven't seen gigs led by the other people. They have a shared language. It's just one of those miraculous things, you know?
And what's in that language?
It's not just somebody soloing over chord changes and they know how to – it's not just a consensual language of moving forward through a set pattern of harmony or anything like that. It's an instinctive language of like understanding where the surges are going to happen and where the tailing off is going to happen and what can be done in certain sections. They just know. For whatever reason, I've been reading about this linguist named Jill Bowie, and she has this whole idea about something she calls proto-discourse. And it's like we're not talking about conversation with words. We're talking about all the other stuff that sort of comes before that and how full that kind of communication can be, even if you're not using words. And it reminds me of what you see when you're watching this band. They just know exactly how to come together toward a crescendo, you know? Their performances are full of these unbelievable surges and then, you know, coming down. That's the thrill of it, you know? It's never just cut and dried. These guys are playing good jazz by the book. There's something more to it. There's some strange background power, you know, that they're all sort of feeling among themselves.
Is it distinctly recognizable to you as a Los Angeles jazz phenomenon?
Well,
in what way are they part of the lineage? You talk in your piece
about
prominent Los Angeles jazz musicians
of
the 50s and 60s. In what way does this fit into that?
Or
does it not?
It doesn't necessarily sound like common practice New York jazz as it might be played by musicians who went to East Coast colleges and are in their early 30s. You know what I mean? No, not really. That stuff is like odd meter music, sort of lots of time tricks. It's thinner.
Mm-hmm.
This is thicker and denser and also more soulful, more groovy. It has more to do with funk. It has a lot to do with gospel too, because these people were playing both in mega churches and in little churches where they would be playing, you know, like shout music. And also I think there's a connection to this kind of early to mid-70s cosmic music especially that you hear on Alice Coltrane records, that kind of thing. There is a connection there in a way with L.A. because she was living out there after John died, and her grandnephew is Flying Lotus, who's part of that whole scene.
And Kamasi's album, which is called The Epic, which we have not said at this point.
That's right.
Is being released on Brainfeeder. Brainfeeder is a label that is founded by Flying Lotus, or at least in part founded by Flying Lotus.
That's right.
And has also released records by folks like Thundercat, the bass player, who is also working near jazz tradition, but not exclusively in a jazz tradition.
But he came up playing jazz. He's one of the Bruner brothers who were close friends with Kamasi from a really early age. In that case, these people actually knew each other since, you know, going back to like age two.
As you say in your piece, we're kind of on the verge of a bunch of the West Coast Get Down guys putting out records that were all recorded in 2011 or 2012.
Yeah, the end of 2011.
So
that's a story in itself too. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a collective. Like there's a history of West Coast jazz, and in which this is the latest chapter, really like a significant chapter. And there's also a history of collectives in jazz, musicians who come together, negotiate their own gigs as a group, and they set up residencies in places. There's like power in numbers. As a collective, they pooled their money and rented a cheap studio in Echo Park for a month in 2011. So there are 10 musicians, and in that time they made 7 records, each one by a different band leader. Mm-hmm. And they'd block out the time into like 3-hour chunks. From 9 to 12, we're going to work on Kamasi's record. From 12 to 3, Miles's record. It took real like strictness to get it all
it's
done.
It's both romantic and unromantic at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what Kamasi ended up with was a huge amount of music. You know, this is – so The Epic, which is his first – the first record under his own name, is a triple disc. The songs are long. I mean, often the songs are up to 15 minutes. Long solos. That stuff also fell out of favor in New York jazz. Like –
but is that
you cut it a little
is
more.
That terseness specific to New York?
Yeah,
and or,
sure.
Or why not? I should say the lack of terseness is something that could only happen outside of New York.
You know the cliches about L.A.?
Yeah.
People are –
they're not cliches. I was just there.
People are
– they're real.
It's kind of real, right?
Yeah, there's no cliches.
It's a different mindset.
That's right.
The laid-back thing is quite real.
At a certain point, I just didn't know which lane I was driving in.
Yeah.
I was like, they all seem fine.
That's right.
They're all pretty open. It's whatever.
So you've got these 15-minute songs, but the musicians are not like super relaxed. I mean, they're on it. This is really alert. Really alert music. And that's what just makes it exciting.
So all these guys have been gigging and side gigs and
sessions. They've all got their own jobs working for other people.
So what was happening in this scene in the first decade of the 2000s? Because obviously these guys got together in some form or fashion in the 90s. What was going on in those 10 years? Because I think if you were to say, if you were to look back at LA, Los Angeles music from 2000 to 2010 and say like, where's the jazz? Or where's the jazz influence stuff?
Mm.
You would end up at Flying Lotus. Like you would end up at Thunder. Like you'd end up at guys like that in terms of folks who are adjacent. Was there real movement in the jazz scene, standalone jazz scene? Was there real movement or were they just sort of laying in wait?
A movement like the kind we're talking about around this West Coast Get Down crew, I don't know. I just don't know the answer to that. I would hear about interesting things going on, little pockets of activity, usually, you know, around one musician or another. But, you know, a movement? I don't know.
Do you think in some sense that the success of Flying Lotus maybe inadvertently set the table for the arrival of this – of Kamasi and his team – to have a higher profile because there's already sort of a generation of listeners? You know, I mean, look, the last time that jazz had sort of a crossover moment in that kind of way is probably the mid-90s in terms of jazz and hip-hop.
You're talking about Guru and all that
stuff.
Yeah,
and so that's kind of set the table for people to be like, hey, I like jazz too.
No, that's absolutely right.
So in a sense, can Kamasi come out and be more of a force now because there's a generation of ears trained on Kamasi adjacent stuff?
I think so. Yes, I do. I think that this brain feeder thing is significant. Mm-hmm. You know, this label, which is an imprimatur and is known now for music with an aesthetic agenda of post-hip-hop moving into improvised music and experimental electronic music. Mm-hmm. There's enough jazz in Kamasi's record for you to point to it and say, yes, that's jazz. Like there's no question about it really. Mm-hmm. But it does go into all these different directions. Like there's a lot of funk in it. There's a lot of I don't know what you call it. R&B, some sort of neo something or other.
Mm-hmm.
Kamasi was actually telling me about how his sister recently came to one of his gigs, and his sister's friends were all talking about how they really do not like jazz. Like they had all decided, you know, they don't like jazz, but they came to the gig and they really liked it. And then the question became, well, is this jazz?
Not do they like jazz,
right.
But is this jazz?
That's right.
That sounds very self-defeating.
I can imagine that conversation being had a lot when people come to hear it. The record is very impressive. There's this idea in culture now where like you unload a huge deluge of material and people have a certain respect for that. Sort of like, you know, when Fugazi put out their archived, you know, live things, they're not going to just do it one at a time.
No,
they're going to give you like 200 hours of it.
Vomitous.
And that's what creates interest. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, that's the way to do it now. As a document, I think Kamasi had the right idea for this record. But I hope that that people will be able to experience this live band outside of LA? I mean, I really hope so, because I don't know. It's just one of those things. It's like startlingly good. Mm-hmm. And it's not good by New York terms. It's good by its own terms.
Okay, with that in mind, let's listen to another song by another promising young Los Angeles jazz artist.
I know your secrets. Moose swings is frequent. I know depression is resting on your heart for two reasons. I know you and a couple black boys ain't been speaking. Y'all damn near beefing, I see it, and you're the reason. And if this bottle could talk, I cry myself to sleep. Everything is your fault. Falls breaking to pieces. Earthquakes on every weekend. Because you shook as soon as you knew confinement was needed. I know your secrets. Don't let me tell them to the world about this shit you thinking. And then time to
made you look. Haha. Okay, that was You from Kendrick Lamar's most recent album, To Pimp a Butterfly. Ben Ratliff, why are we listening to Kendrick Lamar?
One of the producers on Kendrick Lamar's great record is a guy named Terrace Martin. Mm-hmm. And Terrace Martin was one of this crew who played in this after-school band that Kamasi was involved in, you know. So, and Terrace Martin plays a lot of saxophone on the record.
Yes.
So Kamasi was brought in at some stage, I think toward the end.
And Terrace Martin is one of the go-to guys for Kendrick's – in Kendrick's crew.
Right. I think toward the end of making To Pimp a Butterfly, Terrace brought in Kamasi to do some playing but also to write string arrangements. I guess maybe you hear them most prominently on the last track – the imagined interview with Tupac.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But there's probably more of it on there buried under the various layers. You can hear Kamasi Washington on this, you know, important hip-hop record.
And other jazz performers. Isn't Robert Glasper's on the record?
Yes.
A couple other people from Kamasi's crew.
Thundercat is on it.
Yeah, Thundercat's on it.
Actually, I mean, talking to Kamasi about the making of To Pimp a Butterfly was very interesting because Kamasi has a lot of experience working on other people's records. Either jazz or R&B or whatever. Chaka Khan, for example, is somebody that he works with a lot. And he was saying that usually, you know, his contributions to this music is make it legit within the style that it's supposed to be,
right.
You know, conform basically. The instructions for making the Kendrick record were give us what you got. Like we know, especially concerning this crew of musicians, these West Coast Get Down guys, like you have a thing among you. Let's get that, you know. And Kamasi would write string arrangements and he'd say, is this too dense? I can make it thinner. And they'd say, no. Give it to us. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's quite impressive.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is To Pimp a Butterfly a jazz record?
No. Do you think so?
No. But what I do think is that it is more credible to me from a jazz perspective than almost all of the jazz rap in the 90s.
And why do you say that?
It doesn't feel fetishistic to me.
You mean it doesn't take a narrow idea of what jazz is supposed to sound like?
It's not a stick and poke tattoo. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
A lot of the stuff in the 90s to me, and that's not to malign, you know, DJ Premier's ear or gift. It's not to malign Q-Tip's ear or gift. The way that jazz was incorporated into those records was, number one, as a signifier of difference, and number two, in sort of service of an aesthetic that kind of predated it. The aesthetic was there. Jazz was imported into the aesthetic to me, in my perspective. The aesthetic of this record feels very uncertain in a positive way, and therefore what Kamasi and everybody else is able to bring to it actually animates the record in the way that I think a lot of the records in the 90s were not animated by jazz so much as they were. Jazz was a frosting on top of the cake.
If you look after bebop, starting with Coltrane, if you look at the real major innovators in jazz, these are all people who are looking for something that they don't know. And when something swims into their line of vision and they can use it, they're like, yeah, I want to learn about this. I want to add this. I want to mess with it. And I feel like that's the spirit of the Kendrick record.
And
it's not super reductive, fit into the small Kendrick box.
I also think part of that is because of how Kendrick raps. You know, Kendrick is sort of a dense rapper before any of this and one who plays with structure and cadence, sometimes in a way that I frankly find irritating, but is a testament not to his lack of skill, but to his flexibility, you know? I think the idea of him being in a studio and Kamasi coming in and like doing whatever Kamasi does and Kendrick being like, okay, I can work with that because I'm a talented, flexible guy and I can fit in that. That's something that most rappers wouldn't do or wouldn't be able to do. And I think certainly Jazz Rap 1.0 was not there.
Mm-hmm.
Like Jazz Rap 1.0 was in service of, in essence, making a genre that had been perceived as confrontational, coffee house friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the rappers were very like on the one rappers or maybe in the pocket rappers, but not complex rappers.
Right.
Kendrick comes from a very different, I mean, he's not a New York rapper. He's an L.A. rapper. You, if you look at the lineage of L.A. rappers that make sense pre-Kendrick, you go back to, you know, not the West Coast Get Down, but Project Blowed. You look at the mid-90s independent rap, Freestyle Fellowship and folks like that. Whether Kendrick is channeling that stuff consciously or not, there's jazz all over that stuff, inside that stuff.
Let me ask you, as you asked me, you know, is there something gathering around West Coast jazz now? Mm-hmm. Is there something gathering around West Coast hip hop? I mean, between Kendrick, Tyler, the Creator, Earl Sweatshirt, I don't know who else. I mean,
I think it's largely conceptual. I mean, the West Coast hip hop that most people care about right now, besides Kendrick, it's YG, it's Kid Ink, it's, you know, it's DJ Mustard Party Rap.
Right.
There's no jazz. You know what I mean? There's no nothing. There's not.
Is it particularly West Coast?
I would say it is particularly West Coast. I do think we're, over the last 18 months, we've been in a West Coast driven, I think probably for the first time since the 90s, the West Coast is setting a sonic agenda.
But a typical DJ Mustard track, is that West Coast?
It is, although you can make the case that it's descended from hyphy music, Bay Area hyphy from the mid-2000s. In my mind, it's sped up basically Bay Area mob music in the late 80s. DJ Mustard sounds like an early to mid-period Too Short record sped up 40% to me. Mm-hmm. Like that's in my mind. Like that's like the template for it. And DJ Mustard is sort of second generation out of the jerk music scene of the mid-2000s. So that's a particularly West Coast thing. There wasn't East Coast jerk music. Like all that stuff, to me, that's the template. And now, is it specifically West Coast in the way that what Dr. Dre was doing in the 80s and early 90s was so obviously West Coast?
Mm-hmm.
No. But is it locationally specific? Yes, it is locationally specific.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Kendrick belongs to that, strictly speaking. Mm-hmm. Maybe Earl is a better analog for him, although Earl is like far stranger. Tyler maybe is a good musical analog for what Terrace Martin's Soundwave and that whole team is doing. It's tough to fix the West Coast. And I think that's actually a good thing because I think for a long time, you look at how New York rappers and New York producers sort of struggle about how New York they can be.
Right.
And until basically ASAP Rocky came along, it was kind of like, screw all that. Everybody's still sort of like trying to fit into a box of some kind, maybe because there was no West Coast box to fit into for 10 years, that's loosened up what can happen in Los Angeles in a way that has not happened in New York and weirdly is starting to not happen in Atlanta, where all the records are really starting to sound alike.
Mm-hmm. But the only thing I have to stress one more time about what's going on with Kamasi's crew, these 10 guys, is that you don't need to know anything about jazz to go into one of these rooms where they're playing and understand that these people have been playing together for a really long time. It's unmistakable. These are people who have been practicing for like, you know, 4-hour stretch, you know, like just two of them together maybe, you know, playing continuously until their hands are bleeding or whatever. Like there's no mistaking it. With a situation like that, you can have as many people in the group as you want and they can all figure out a way to work with each other. So in Kamasi's group, you've got two drummers, two bass players, two keyboardists, and a bunch of horns, super dense. And then he added later strings and a choir. To my mind, one of the best examples is on this track called The Next Step. The music keeps modulating higher and higher, and the choir comes in, the string comes in, and the whole thing feels like it's going to explode, and then it sort of turns into easy swing.
So let's listen to, from Kamasi Washington's The Epic, a.k.a. Jazzmatazz 7, So Fast, So Furious, let's listen to The Next Step. Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Ben Ratliff has been our guest. I've been your host, John Caramonica. You can read Ben Ratliff writing about Kamasi Washington at nytimes.com/music. Kamasi Washington's The Epic comes out on May 5th. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. Listen to our Spotify playlist. Our producers are John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll be back next week.